G'day everyone, this is B. Jemine, aka The Terrible Australian, and welcome to my very first edition of my 2019 at Melbourne International Film Festival audio reviews. For those out there who don't know what the Melbourne International Film Festival is, or MIFF as it's also known by its shorter name, MIFF is a film festival that takes place in my adoptive home city of Melbourne in the month of August, where so many different films from all over the world, some of which that have played at the Sundance Film Festival, the Cannes Film Festival, the Berlin Film Festival, and so many others, are showcased here in Melbourne over the course of 18 days. And for me personally, as a film fan and critic, this time of year is like Christmas time for me, because it's one of those festivals where I get to just get to go watch so many movies every day and even catch up with other film critic friends and of mine as well. And just seeing so many different wide variety of films. And this year, like so many previous years at the festival, is a great showcase of so many different films of genres, films from different countries, and just it's a great wide variety of films. And that's what I love so much about MIFF, is that they get to showcase so many of them. And this will be my 8th year covering the film festival for supermarcy.com. So if you have heard my previous audio reviews or video reviews on all the films that I've seen at MIFF over the last couple years, so you'll know what to expect. Just like I did last year, this year I'm going to be doing mini podcasts on all the films that I've seen at MIFF. Because in the early years when I was covering the film festival, I used to do, say, either a video or audio review of one film per review. And then it moved up to eventually two per review. But last year, since I saw 60 films, I decided to change that to 4 films per review. So I'm going to be doing that again this year, since I'm seeing about 58 films, which still does sound like a lot, but since this is actually 2 films down from last year where I saw 60, I consider that a bit of an improvement, because over the last couple of years, every time I put my viewing list together for the festival, it always seems to get bigger and bigger and bigger. So the fact that it's 2 movies down this year, I consider quite an improvement if you ask me. So for this very first installment, I'll be talking about the very first 4 films that I saw at MIFF this year, which of course are Matthias and Maxime, Measure for Measure, One Child Nation, and Sorry We Missed You. So let's get right to it. And first up, of course, is Matthias and Maxime, which of course is the latest film from French-Canadian writer, director, and actor Xavier Dolan. And the plot summary for this film, which I am reading off the MIFF program guide, is as follows. Best friends since childhood, queer Maxime, played by Dolan himself, and straight Matthias, and I'm probably going to butcher this actor's name, so please forgive me, Gabriel de Armadia Fretiers, continue to keep the same company of affable 20-something Quebecan bros, even as their paths diverge. The former is derailed caring for his mother, played by Dolan's ever-wonderful maternal muse, Anne Dorval, while the latter is entertaining obnoxious clients as he climbs the corporate law ladder. But a play-acting kiss uncorks a rollercoaster of emotions that they can't be suppressed, and Dolan navigates the simmering tension with beautiful poise and personal assurance. Now, one of the main reasons why I was very much looking forward to Matthias and Maxime, despite the fact that it's directed by Xavier Dolan, who I think is one of the most interesting auteurs working in cinema today, is that for a lot of critics who saw this film at the Cannes Film Festival a couple of months back, that this film was a true return to form for him as a filmmaker, after sort of the very mixed to negative reception that his 2 previous films, It's Only the End of the World and The Death and Life of John F. Donovan. So with that in mind, like I haven't seen John F. Donovan, so I can't really say the quality of that film, but I know that I wasn't really much of a fan of It's Only the End of the World, which, despite the sort of the great acting talent that was on display, it just didn't really quite come together as a film. So with that in mind, I was very much looking forward to checking out this film. Like I said, Xavier Dolan's definitely one of the most interesting filmmakers who are working today, and he always brings a very unique sort of visual style and voice to every film he brings, no matter what type of genre he tackles. So with that in mind, now that I've finally seen the film, I have to say I thought it was a really solid movie. Like, I don't think it's up there as one of his best works, but it's still a really well-made and beautifully done film that features really strong performances, not just from him as an actor, but also from his co-star. And once again, if I butcher this actor's name, please forgive me. Gabriel D. Amadia Friotes. And for me, this film is really about their characters' relationship with each other. And it's a really interesting and complex one too, because sort of at the very beginning of the film, we sort of know that these are guys who have been best friends since they were kids. And after sort of the enticing incident where they're kind of forced into by one of their friends to kiss for a short film that she was directing, that's when sort of like a lot of repressed emotions start to come to the surface, particularly with Matthias, because his journey through the film is really interesting, because even though Maxime is a very sort of openly queer character, but Matthias, on the other hand, is very much, he comes across as very straight, and being that he's a very masculine guy who's in a relationship with a woman. But then once this the kiss happens, it kind of sort of stirs him up both emotionally and mentally, because he doesn't know how to sort of react to this. And in a lot of ways, it opens up sort of memories of another kind of kissing incident that he and Maxime had when they were younger. So it kind of makes him start to question his own sexuality. And I think for me, that is one of the key things about the film that I really liked and made it very compelling. And as these two men kind of try to work out their feelings for each other, do they go forward with these feelings, or do they sort of just, you know, suppress them even more and not ruin their own friendship? And to me, the film does that really well, and you could definitely tell that Dolan brings a lot of a personal touch to this film. I don't know if this is kind of based on something that happened to him in his real life, but when I was sort of watching the film, you kind of get the sense there is that this felt very personal to him, as this story in particular felt very personal to him. And I think that, and even if it's not based on anything that happened to him personally, it has that touch to it that for me makes, I think anyone, regardless of gender, can relate to the film on some level. And also, the film definitely has all the hallmarks that Dolan is known for as a filmmaker, like the sort of the different aspect ratio changes come into play, the use of pop music as well, and kind of the mixing of humor and drama, and also a lot of sort of stylistic moments as well. And I have to say, as from a writing and directing standpoint, Dolan does a really wonderful job. It's not to say that the film doesn't have its negative aspects as well. I feel like for the first 20 minutes were a bit rough, mainly because, and this is one sort of trademark of his as a filmmaker, he likes to do a lot of close-ups on actors' faces. So he does that a lot during the first 15-20 minutes of the film, during the first act. But the way how it's sort of done, it's sort of very handheld and quickly edited as well. And I have to admit, that did sort of put me off a little bit, and I just found it a little irritating. But funnily enough, when the actual kiss happens, that's when the filmmaking starts to ease down a bit and becomes a bit more focused. And which I was really happy about, because it made me at least get back into being more involved with the story. And also, I gotta say this, and I don't know if anyone else noticed this or not, but the ending of the film, which I'm not going to spoil, reminded me way too much of a film that I saw at MIFF a couple of years back. Seriously, the way how this ending is staged and put together is exactly the same as another film that I saw a few years back. I'm not going to say what that film is, but it was a film I actually did review at MIFF, and I was actually shocked that
that the ending for this, for Mathias and Maxime, is pretty much exactly the same. Even the end song that Dolan uses to end the film on is exactly the same as the one that was used in the other film I saw a few years back. So I kept thinking, like, is this just a coincidence? Or is this kind of Dolan making a homage to that film? Because I didn't get a chance to find out if Dolan had saw that other film yet or not. But I wouldn't be surprised if it was meant to be kind of a homage, because it can't be a coincidence, at least for me, that the endings to his film and that other film are pretty much exactly the same. And honestly, it kind of blew my mind when it happened. And I sort of mentioned it to another film critic friend of mine, and he didn't even notice it until I mentioned it to him, and it kind of blew his mind as well. So, but that being said, though, I think Mathias and Maxime is a really solid and well-crafted little film. Like I said, I don't think it's one of Dolan's best, but it's still a really solid and engaging one that has some very strong performances. Both Dolan and co-star Gabriel D'Amadia-Pretiers, and once again, if I butchered his name, please forgive me, are both give great performances, particularly Pretiers, who I think is definitely has the most interesting and complex character of the two. And also the supporting cast are all really solid as well. And Orville, who I've seen in previous Dolan films as well, is also really compelling as Maxime's mother. It's beautiful. It's nicely directed, really well written, nicely shot, despite the rough first 20 minutes, and also has some great songs and score. Like, it's just a really solid little film from Xavier Dolan. Not up there as one of his best for me, but it's still a really solid one nonetheless. So if I had to give Mathias and Maxime a rating, I'd give it a solid 3.5 out of 5. Now, moving on to the next film, which is the Australian crime drama Measure for Measure, which is sort of a reinterpretation of the William Shakespeare play of the same name. And the plot summary for this one, which I'm once again reading off the Myth Program Guide, is as follows. Reimagining the Barbs play about morality, mercy, and justice in a tropical tale of love and loyalty, porno director Paul Island and his co-writer, the late Damien Hill, have crafted a touching story about a young Muslim woman, Jawara, who falls in love with a non-Muslim musician, Claudio. Jawara's shady brother, Farouk, objects to their union and frames Claudio for a crime he didn't commit, sending him to jail. Desperate to save Claudio, Jawara seeks the help of Duke, a local crime boss currently on leave, whose second-in-command, Angelo, offers to assist in his stead, but at what cost? Now, Measure for Measure was definitely one of the big, high-profile films to play at MIFF, and the screening I went to was the world premiere of the film. And before even the film was played at MIFF, it had sort of a very tragic backstory behind it, because Damien Hill, who is the star and writer of Paul Island's previous film, Porno, and as well as the lead in the film West of Sunshine, died a few days just before shooting this film began, and so, which was very tragic. So the film was pushed back a few weeks, and he was recast by his role in the film, because he was originally going to play the role of Angelo, but after his death, Mark Leonard Winter took over the role instead. So the film definitely had that sort of very tragic backstory to it. And so when we, like myself and the audience, went into it, you could definitely sort of tell from the very beginning and from the end that there's sort of a mournful feeling to the film because of what happened to Damien Hill prior to the film being shot. And the film, like beforehand, we did have, there was like a couple sort of introductions and also some beautiful little moving tributes to Damien Hill before the film began. So with that in mind, what is Measure for Measure like as a film overall? I kind of feel bad about saying this, and I still do, but I have to say this because, you know, as a film critic, I have to be truthful and honest about my opinion. I wasn't really a fan of Measure for Measure, which kind of makes me really feel bad, especially with everything that happened behind the scenes of this film. But that being said, though, I think for me, the film just doesn't really work as a whole. And I wasn't really a fan of Paul Island's previous film, Porno, either. Like, it had some interesting elements to it and some solid acting. But it just, that film to me just was very flawed. And Measure for Measure, unfortunately, is even more so. For me, I like it when filmmakers take Shakespearean stories and sort of reinterpret them to the modern age, even if it doesn't mean necessarily using the same dialogue from the play, but using sort of the plot to create something interesting and unique. And I give Measure for Measure that, but because I haven't read or even seen the original Shakespeare play, so I can't really say how this film as an adaptation compares to it. But as a film on its own, the reason why I don't think it really worked for me as well is because I kind of feel like as a crime film, it just didn't really provide anything too new or original. And there are some interesting elements to it. And I like the fact that the film does have characters in it who are of a Muslim background, because that sort of adds an interesting sort of layer to the film, and having these sort of different kind of crime gangs kind of go against each other, and having this sort of almost sort of love story between a Muslim woman and a non-Muslim Caucasian man being at the center of it. Almost, it kind of reminded me a little bit of Romeo and Juliet in that way. But this one sort of course, takes a very different route to how it approaches the love aspect of the story. And also, like, from a writing standpoint, the film is just came across as rather clunky and also very unsubtle in how it sort of approached sort of some scenes and as well as the themes of the story. And you could tell that they wanted to make this film very relevant to the times that we're living in at the moment. But I feel like on a thematic level, it just came off very heavy-handed. And also, Paul Island's direction felt exactly the same as well, because a lot of the sort of the big dramatic scenes in the film just felt like he came at it with a sledgehammer due to how very heavy-handed it was. And also, there were just scenes that kind of made my eyes roll, and just how sort of either almost soap opery or very cliched or cartoonish that they came across. So on those levels, it didn't really work for me. And also some of the performances, like, I feel like the performances in the film were definitely kind of a bit of a mixed bag overall. It has a sort of a mixture of some really solid performances and some performances that just didn't really work for me. But in terms of who I thought stand out the most, I'd definitely say Megan Haja, and I probably butchered her last name, so please forgive me, who plays the character of Jawara, and I probably butchered that character's name too, so please forgive me. I feel like she definitely gives one of the strongest performances in the film, even though I kind of feel that the film isn't really working around her, but she gives a really strong and consistent performance throughout, and you do feel for her character every step of the way. And Harrison Gilbertson, who I think is also a pretty solid actor as well, and I think he does well for most part for his performance here, but there are some moments where he didn't really quite convince me as well. And also Markland Winter, who plays the role of Angelo, I thought he was pretty interesting as well. I kind of wish the film kind of delved into more of his character, because there are definitely some aspects about him as a character that were interesting, but I don't feel like the film kind of really delved into it as much as it could have. But for me, of course, other than Megan Haja, definitely one of the best performances in the film is definitely Hugo Weaving. Like, no matter what type of film Hugo Weaving is in, whether it's a good film or a bad film, you know for a fact that he is going to give a strong work no matter what. And he does once again here as well. And to me, along with Haja, he also is very consistent with his performance throughout. And he's a very sort of interesting and likable gangster. Like, he's someone who definitely has honor about him and is kind of going through his own struggles as well, dealing with a lot of things that are that have happened in his life. And for me, he's also Hugo Weaving was definitely one of the most, gave one of the most compelling performances in the film to me. So overall, while I definitely admire Measure for Measure on a number of levels, the fact that they still went ahead and made this film, despite the tragedy that happened behind the scenes, is very commendable. And I give them all the credit for that, because this would have been a very hard film to make, knowing that one of the big key creative figures behind this film, who it was not, passed away shortly before they made the film. Because not only Damien Hill was originally going to star in the film, he also co-wrote and produced the film as well. But unfortunately, I think as a film overall, it just didn't really come together for me. It just had too many flaws to make it work as a film. And I also have to say, I didn't really like the very final scene of the film. It just didn't really quite work for me either. And it just felt kind of a little bit of a slap to the face, and it wasn't really kind of needed. But that being said, though, it is, at the end of the day, a tribute to Damien Hill, who was definitely a very up-and-coming, worthy talent of Australian cinema. And it's sad that he passed away. But at the same time, though, the film, on it as it is on its own, just didn't really quite work for me. But I can imagine this will be a film that definitely will work for a lot of people. Unfortunately, it just had too many problems for it to work for me. So if I had to give Measure for Measure a rating, I give it a solid 2 out of 5. Now, moving on to my third film, which of course is the documentary One Child Nation, which explores the infamous one child policy that happened in China for 36 years. And the plot summary for this one, which once again I'm reading from the Myth Program Guide, is as follows. Officially, China's one child policy ended in 2015. But after 36 years of operation, the restrictive regime isn't easily shaking. Interviewing both victims and instigators and delving into her own traumatic family history, filmmaker Nan Fu Wang not only uncovers the heartbreaking truths that have been kept secret for decades, but also trains her gaze on the gender discrimination at the center of Chinese society. Now, I have to admit, like, I always heard about the one child policy that China had for many decades, but I only kind of knew only the basics of it, but I didn't really sort of know the full extent of what this policy had on China as a nation and for its people. So going into this film, I was definitely fascinated to know about that. And I gotta say, this film floored me. Like, I kind of had an idea of what a policy like this could do to an entire nation and as well as its people, but I just never knew from the damage that it did. And what I really like about this film as well is that even though it does delve into the horrible effects that happened once this policy came in, but it also shows having some of the figureheads and also the interviewees kind of talk about, like, even though, yeah, it was bad, but in a lot of ways it kind of saved China as well, which I found pretty interesting, but also made me very uneasy as well, especially when the film delves into sort of the negative effects that this policy had. It's very shocking and very confronting and deeply disturbing as well. And there's definitely a lot of images that appeared throughout this film that is definitely gonna stay with me for quite a while, and I'm not gonna say what they are because again, that's in spoiler territory. But let's just say that a lot of what happens in the film is very confronting and will definitely disturb viewers. But I feel like this is an important doco that needs to be seen. And I think, and what I really like, the fact that having someone like a co-director, Nanfu Wang, who directed the, be kind of at the center of this film, kind of having her own personal view of this whole situation, since she actually lived through all of this, definitely makes it a much more compelling film, because like I said, it brings a personal eye to this policy, and that the fact that she goes around and interviews people in her family and people that she knew who either were struggling with this policy, but also those who were also a part of it as well and did some of the atrocities in the name of it as well, is really interesting. And also kind of delves into, kind of like I said in the from the plot synopsis, the discrimination that that women faced as well, because a lot of the times most Chinese families wanted the boy to sort of carry on the name, but when if a lot of the families only had a girl, either some of them were either shipped off to orphanages or just left somewhere to die. And it's very, very powerful stuff and really compelling. And it's also just a complete eye-opener as well. And to, like I said, as someone who kind of knew very little about the one-child policy, this film definitely just was just fascinating to me as a viewer. And I definitely recommend this documentary a lot. Like, especially for those who like knew very little about it. But I think even though people out there who actually know a lot more about it will definitely find this one very compelling as well, because not only, like I said, delves into the whole sort of the policy, the propaganda, which watching the propaganda videos in particular is fascinating because they're so cheesy and so badly done, but yet at the same time you can understand, but everyone fell for it as well. And you would think, as kind of, you know, as a Westerner, like, how can anyone fall for this type of stuff? But, like, in the world we're living in now, where there is so much propaganda anywhere, rather in, it's easy to see why. And for me, like I said, it, dealing with the sort of the after effects of the policy, the propaganda, and as well as other aspects as well, but also, but seeing it through the eyes of someone who lived through it as well. So this is what I feel like the film does really well, is having that sort of real personal story at the center of a much bigger one as well. And to me, that kind of really hooked me in as a viewer. And that reason alone, I have to say that, you know, it when One Child Nation comes out, definitely seek it out, because it is a great doco. It's an important one, and one that I feel that everyone needs to see, because you're gonna, because as confronting and disturbing of a film it is, it's a very powerful one, and one that I have to say really moved me as well, because it sort of showcased something that for me, as I said, I knew very little about, but one that sort of talks about a very sort of dark part of China's history. And that alone is one, just one of the many reasons why everyone should check out this documentary. Like, if I had any negative things about it, I think there were some aspects I would have liked to have seen the film delve into a little bit more. But other than that, it's still a really great documentary that I definitely recommend everyone to check out. So if I had to give One Child Nation a rating, I give it a 4 out of 5. It is a great doco that definitely is worth seeking out. Now onto my fourth and final film, which of course is Ken Loach's latest film, Sorry We Missed You. And the plot summary for this film is as follows. Proud of his work ethic, Ricky takes a freelance courier job not only to make ends meet or to pay off the debt that he's been struggling with since the 2008 financial crash, but to provide a better future for his aged carer wife and their two teenage children. But happiness, prosperity, and navigating the gig economy go rarely hand in hand, especially for everyday workers. Now, when I sit down to watch a Ken Loach film, I know exactly what to expect because even though now he is 83 years old, he is still a very passionate filmmaker. And in all the films that I have seen of his over the years, no matter whether it's a drama or a comedy or something in between, he is a director who has something to say, and the fact, and he'll take any sort of social topic that is happening in our world right now and explore it in a way that is very passionate. And watching Sorry We Missed You, you can definitely feel his anger that a lot of sort of companies and businesses kind of treat their workers throughout this film. And in a lot of ways, the film kind of delves into kind of similar themes to his previous film, I, Daniel Blake, which in that film was about a working class man who was being messed around by both the government and job agencies. This time, though, with this film, he sort of shows us a working class family who are struggling financially, being messed around by businesses, but also sort of the struggles that they faced together as a family every day in their own personal lives. So this is a film that definitely has a lot of stuff that it wants to explore. And for most part, I think Ken Loach does a really good job at exploring that. And you get caught up in the story and as well as the lives of this family, and you can't help but feel everything that they're going through and the hardships and the pain and the anger that they face. And you want this family, want good things for this family, but they just keep being messed around, and it's very frustrating. And I don't mean that in on like a filmmaking level, but I meant in terms of how sort of these businesses really do that to working class people who are just trying to live their lives day to day, paycheck to paycheck, but like they just keep being messed around by these businesses who just treat them so poorly. And Ken Loach does a really good job exploring that while also giving us a human face at the center of it. But unfortunately though, I feel as, even though I think it's a really solid film overall, I don't think it's as great as it could have been. And I think the main reason why that is because he, like I said before, he kind of already explored this kind of themes and material in his previous film, I, Daniel Blake, which I thought was a terrific film that really sort of went head tilt into the subject matter and the themes that it went into. And it kind of seems to me like Ken Loach won, and his co-writer, Paul Laverty, who also wrote I, Daniel Blake, want to explore that again, just with different characters and a different setting and different circumstances as well, like what's happening to them. But I don't, so in a way, like in a lot of ways that still does work, because like I said, we get really involved with the family at the center of it and all their struggles that they're going through. But again, on a thematic level, we've seen this before, and not only just in I, Daniel Blake, but also in other previous films that Ken Loach has made over the years as well. So in a lot of ways, the film doesn't really sort of say anything that we haven't already seen before in other Ken Loach films. And that's not to say that's a bad thing, because like no matter where Ken Loach makes his films, like throughout the years, and whatever topics he tackles, they're always still going to be very relevant today. Like I said before, we kind of already seen him tread this ground before, in my opinion, in a much better way in I, Daniel Blake. And it's not to say that the film's bad or anything. I just feel like we've kind of already seen this type of story before and from him recently. And do we really kind of need to see that again? But given the sort of the times and the world we're living in right now, I think despite my feelings on that, it's important that a film like this still get made. Even though I kind of wish Loach kind of delved into these films in a much different way so it didn't feel too resentment to I, Daniel Blake. But for most part, it's still a solid film, and I definitely felt engaged by it as well. And also, I can feel that anger that's coming in through the film, and also the sort of the frustrations that these characters feel, and you really do feel for them. And the cast just do a really good job playing these characters, and they do just a solid job with their performances. But like I said, I just feel like we kind of already seen this story before and just done better. But that being said, Sorry We Missed You is still a pretty solid film from Ken Loach. Not one of his best, it's still a solid one nonetheless. At least for me anyway. But so if I had to give this one a rating, I give it a solid 3 out of 5. So yep, that's the end of this very first edition of my 2019 MIFF audio reviews. I hope you guys all enjoyed it. And keep a lookout very soon for my second edition, in which I'll be reviewing the films In Fabric, Baccarat, Come to Daddy, and Memory, The Origins of Aliens. So keep a lookout for that one, and I'll see you all then. See you guys. Bye.